The book of 2 Kings, the 18th chapter, beginning with the first verse. In the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the father of the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done. He removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him. Wherever he went out, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. In the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea the son of Elah, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, he took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. The king of Assyria carried the Israelites away to Assyria and put them in Halah and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant. Even all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded. They neither listened nor obeyed. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. And the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts that Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. When they arrived, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway to the washer's field. And when they called for the king, there came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. And the Rabshakeh said to them, Say to Hezekiah, Thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, What do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you are trusting now in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. But if you say to me, We trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, You shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses, if you are able on your part to set riders on them. How then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants, when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Moreover, is it without the Lord that I have come up against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, Go up against this land and destroy it. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah, said to the Rabshakeh, Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the language of Judah, within the hearing of the people who are on the wall. But the Rabshakeh said to them, Has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and to drink their own urine? Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord by saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me and come out to me. Then each one of you will eat of his own vine and each one of his own fig tree, and each one of you will drink the water of his own cistern until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die. And do not listen to Hezekiah when he misleads you by saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations ever delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Ivah? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? But the people were silent and answered him not a word. For the king's command was, do not answer him. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of the Rabshakeh. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be unto God. Please be seated. Now, we're familiar with the phrase, like father, like son. And it's often true. There are sons who have the same or similar interests or skills or temperaments as their fathers, but it's not always the case. I grew up with a family who had three sons. All three sons were friends. And today, all three of these sons have good jobs. They have excellent reputations and are faithful Christian men who love the Lord and their families. And they're very much different than their father before them, who was a harsh taskmaster of a man who himself was a slave to the bottle and to his job. And so today these sons could not be any more unlike their father. Now, when you come to the account of Hezekiah, the king of Ahaz, you have to remember what Ahaz is like. It's almost charitable to say that Ahaz was an ungodly man, because he was far worse than that. He was a man who rejected God for idolatry. He installed a pagan altar in the temple of God and essentially shut the temple down from the worship of God. And then he was so wicked that he burned some of his own sons as sacrifices to his idols or to his God, something that wicked King Ahab of Israel, as far as we know, had not even done. So Ahaz is about as bad as they come in Judah so far. Yes, there will be one worse than him. And while we wouldn't expect Hezekiah to be much better than his father, he will prove to be one of the best kings to ever sit on the throne of Jerusalem. Maybe even the best of the kings. So let's look at, and we'll look at two or three different sections here, but the first section is verses 1 through 12, and it's a summary of Hezekiah's reign. And the first eight verses that we read give a summary of him, something that we've come to expect for each king as they're described in these two books. It's likely that Hezekiah reigned as what's known as a co-regent with his father Ahaz for about 14 years until his father's death. And during that time, the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. And there's a summary that's given to us in verses 9 through 12. And when you read those, you think back to the previous chapter, and we wonder, why do we need that here? Because chapter 17 gave a long and lengthy summary of the fall of Israel to the Assyrians. And it seems here restated and summarized to repeat the fall as a reminder of the high cost of sin and rebellion against God, and also to show that the Assyrian nation was still an existing threat to the people of Judah, where Hezekiah serves. Now, Hezekiah began to reign on his own about 7 years after Israel's destruction, which would put the beginning of his solo reign at around 715 B.C. He was 25 years old at that time, and he reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. Now, if you'll notice with me in verse 3, there is the summary assessment or spiritual assessment of Hezekiah, that he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David, his father, had done. Now, if you were to go and look at all the kings of Judah, you'll find that there is no other king about whom that is said without any qualification, that he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all David, his father, had done. Now, if you would think back to his great-grandfather, Amaziah, it was said that he did what was right, yet not like David, his father. And there is said of others that they did what was right in God's eyes, except they did not remove the high places, those unauthorized sacrificial sites on hilltops that may have been for the worship of God, but during the reign of a wicked king could easily degenerate into idol worship. That all these other kings have some qualification to their devotion to God, many times because they were half-hearted in that devotion. But not Hezekiah. He's all in. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as David, his father, had done. So here is finally a king that meets the standard of David in terms of faithfulness to God. And you can see what we might call his performance appraisal spiritually in verses 5 and 6. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. High words of praise for this king. Now, if you look in verse 4, there's a brief overview of the religious reforms that were performed by Hezekiah. He removed the high places, so he did what so many others had failed to do. He broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah, so he removed these pagan images from Judah. And then we're told that he destroyed this bronze serpent that had been made by Moses. In a day when the people of Israel had grumbled against Moses and God sent fiery serpents to bite the people, and those who were bitten died. But Moses placed this bronze serpent in the middle of the camp, and those who looked to the serpent were healed. Jesus picked up that image in John 3 and said that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, describing and predicting his death on the cross. Well, in time, the people of God began to worship the image, and they made offerings to it. And it was called Nehushtan, which means bronze thing. A very, very simple description. Years ago, I think around 1998, Ann and I went to a pastors and wives conference in Birmingham. And there was a preacher named Haddon Robinson who was well known for writing in Our Daily Bread and with the group there. And he preached a message about that particular text. And the name of the sermon was When Good Snakes Go Bad. A serpent, a bronze serpent that the people would look at and trust God was replaced God in a sense in their worship. Now, in that verse 4, we have just one verse that describes the religious reforms. Second Chronicles devotes three chapters to that and the things that Hezekiah did in the land. Purging the land of idolatry, of the places for worship, the images. He cleansed and restored the temple. He reestablished the Passover. And he organized the priests to serve. In essence, Ahaz had shut the temple down and Hezekiah restored it. Then you look in verses 7 and 8, there's a brief summary of his military success as well. His father, Ahaz, had submitted Israel or submitted Judah to the authority of Assyria. And one of the things that meant was an annual tribute payment to them. Well, Hezekiah ended this and rebelled against Assyria, refusing to pay the tribute money. He also made war against the Philistines and took control of their territory as far as Gaza, which gives rise to another comparison to David, because these are the only two kings of whom it is said they defeated the Philistines. And the reason for the success is given at the beginning of verse 7. If you'll notice the words, "And the Lord was with him." The Lord was with him. That's only said of Hezekiah and David. And we're also told that wherever he went out, he prospered. The same things are said of David, that when he went out and when he came in, as he was leading the armies under Saul, that God blessed and prospered him and gave him success. And so Hezekiah here is essentially like a new David to us. There is a prominence of his reign and a blessing of God upon his reign like no other king since the days of David. So when you look at Hezekiah in these verses, you're presented of a model of a godly king. And in this model of how there is a relationship between faith and works, or faith and deeds, Hezekiah was a man who trusted God. And although it is not said in so many words, Hezekiah was a man who was on the receiving end of grace. That is the only explanation for how this godly man and this godly king became such after the influence of such an ungodly father and a pagan king as Ahaz. That God worked in the heart of Hezekiah to produce faith, contrary to everything that he had seen and all that he had heard and everything he had experienced at the side of his father. So because of his faith in God and his utter reliance upon God, Hezekiah lived a faithful life. Now, we've read these verses, and I want you to see the flow from the very first part of verse 5. Notice, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. And then verse 6, for he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him. He kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. That Hezekiah, his life flows from trusting God to holding fast to God and following the commandments of God. Because Hezekiah's eyes were on God in worship and dependence, in loving God and trusting God. And in doing so, he's enabled by the Spirit and by the grace of God to do those things that please God and those things that bring him glory. Think of Peter when Jesus came walking across the sea to the boat in the middle of the storm, and Peter said, "Lord, if it's you, bid me come to you." And Jesus said, "Come." And so Peter began to walk on the water. But then when he took his eyes off Jesus and he began to look at the sea around, he began to sink. Hezekiah trusted God. And when he trusts in God, he does those things that please him. This goes back to what we've looked at and talked about so many times through Kings. And it goes back to John 15, where Jesus told his disciples, "Abide in me, and I in you. Without me, you can do nothing. But with me, by my power, by my grace, you can do all things. You can do everything that I have called you to do." One of our first responsibilities as a Christian is to trust God, to rely upon him, to seek him in his word, and to do those things that he calls for us to do by his grace and by his power. Now, look in verses 13 through 16, and you'll see where Hezekiah stumbles here. It's likely that when we said earlier Hezekiah refused to pay tribute to Assyria any longer, that took place during a time when Assyria was dealing with internal difficulties. There were struggles within among the king. and others around him, but also at a time when there are other rebellious nations who are rejecting Assyria's authority, like Babylon and Egypt. Now, in time, the Assyrian king was able to stabilize things, and when he dies, then he turns his attention to Judah. Judah was far less a threat to him than Babylon and Egypt. Now that they have been calmed, he turns again to Judah. And he invaded the western side of Judah. And he captured all the fortified cities in the western portion of Judah, including the major fortified city of Lachish, which was finally taken, and it is some 40 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And when he has that, the only thing that is left is Jerusalem. And so now Jerusalem is in his sights. And Hezekiah knew this. And so he took measures to, according to Chronicles, to defend the city of Jerusalem and prepare them for a long siege. Things like fortifying the city walls, stocking supplies, and making sure there's an adequate supply of water for the city. He also took measures to cut off the springs outside of Jerusalem to diminish the amount of fresh water that the Assyrians would be able to use. And so when you come into these early verses, 13 and 14, Jerusalem and her king are in danger because of the Assyrians. And so it sort of leads to a question, reflecting back in verses 1 through 8, as to why is this happening now? Look at Hezekiah. Look at his devotion. Look at the religious reforms that he had made in order to turn the hearts of the people of Jerusalem to God. A faithful, godly king who trusted God greatly. So you see nothing written bad about him in his summary. So how could this take place during a period of renewal and even revival? Why, for someone who is following you, do you allow such trouble to come? Well, here we have to be on guard against what has been called recipe theology. Now, you'll see how ignorant I am of food recipes. But if you take, and do it properly, flour and egg, oil, butter, and water, put those together, put it in the oven, what do you get? Cake. Some semblance of cake. If you do that, well, the idea behind recipe theology is that if we do certain things, then we can expect certain things from God. So if I read my Bible daily, if I pray regularly, if I attend worship services, if I give, if I do other things that God says that I should do, then I'm going to get the outcome that I want. I'm not going to have trouble. I'm not going to have difficulty in my life. So you will not have a flat tire. You'll not be audited by the IRS. You'll not get the stomach virus. Well, that's not how the Christian life works in a fallen world. We still are subject to all the miseries of this life, the Shorter Catechism, question 19. And we can know this from history as well as our own past, because there are many of the great servants of God who have suffered much in their lives. The Apostle Paul, for instance, if you want to read a catalog of his suffering, go to the end of 2 Corinthians and read the things that he endured. One of the greatest preachers who ever lived was Charles Spurgeon. Spurgeon suffered greatly from depression and was debilitated at times because of gout. Are you looking in modern days, one of the great servants of the Lord who has encouraged so many people, particularly those who are suffering, is Johnny Erickson Tada. We're not immune from trouble. We're not immune from suffering. And Hezekiah is not either, and he's going to be called to suffer in the people of Jerusalem because of the Assyrians. And so when he is gripped with that, with what he is facing and the people that he leads are facing, he appeals for mercy from Sennacherib, who is the king of Assyria. In verse 14, ask what you want, I'll pay it. I haven't paid tribute, ask now, I'll give it to you. Just tell me the amount. And he's faced with a punishing, exorbitant amount of tribute. Warren Wiersbe says that the amounts that are described here are 11 tons of silver and a ton of gold. So Hezekiah plundered his own wealth and the treasuries of the temple, but that's not enough. So he stripped the gold plating from the doors of the temple in order to raise the funds. That's humiliating to Hezekiah. That's humiliating to the people of Jerusalem. And so we have to ask here, how can a man whose heart was so focused on God yield to the demands of a pagan king? Well, the simple truth is that he panicked. He's not the first king of Jerusalem to do that. But when you see that, it seems to run afoul to what we've read in verses 3 and 5 and 6 about how he followed God. And there was no one like him, and yet he does this. And so it seems contradictory. But what you have to see and remember, again, is those first 8 verses are a summary of the entirety of Hezekiah's reign. It doesn't say he's perfect. Yes, that is the tenor of his reign. A faithful, godly man like David, who likewise received the highest appraisal by God, but not a perfect man. Again, Spurgeon once said, the best of men are still men at best. And Luther said that this phrase that came to be the title of this message, at the same time righteous and a sinner. A man of God, but yes, a man still with a sin nature. And I've also heard and used the term before, wretched saints, righteous, and yet still sinning. Hezekiah made a bad decision, a terrible decision, but one that he likely thought was best for Jerusalem. If he paid the tribute, as other kings had done before him, then Assyria would turn away. Or to put it another way, Hezekiah at this moment was not trusting God. He trusted the Assyrian king to keep his word, instead of trusting that God would keep his promises. Israel has fallen because of their sin. Hezekiah is doing all that he can, according to God's word, to lead the people of Judah in a different direction. But he's not trusting God to keep his promise. And trusting a pagan king like Sennacherib would be like trusting a mafia thug to take your protection money payment and then promise to walk away and leave you alone. Hezekiah had earlier defied the Assyrian king. He was a man who was not prone to forgive and forget. A man who was not to be trusted. There's a former state auditor of Mississippi who often repeated the sort of the motto of his office. In God we trust, all others we audit. Same thing here. God alone proves to be trustworthy and faithful and full of grace. Hezekiah had faltered in his faith, but God would not falter in his goodness to him or his faithfulness to his people. God has been working with and through flawed sinners since Adam's sin in the garden. That's what he has to work with. And Paul gave some encouraging words to Timothy in his second letter, 2:13, where he says that if we are faithless, he remains faithful. Even when we fail, when we falter, God remains faithful to us. There's a really good Christian movie called Do You Believe? And in the movie, there's one of the characters is a man named Joe, who was a former prisoner who had become a Christian, who was dying. And he was in the hospital just minutes away from death. There was a friend who asked him if he was afraid to die. And Joe said, no. Jesus has a soft spot for sinners, so I figure I'm all set. Jesus died to forgive us. And one of the sins that he has forgiven us is unbelief. Because there are times when we trust ourselves or we trust something else rather than trusting him. And he forgives us of those times that we failed him, like Peter. When, even though Jesus had warned him, Peter sinned in denying Jesus three times. Now, this does not give us, as believers, a license to sin. Paul would say in Romans, but yes, you know, if, you know, I teach that God's grace abounds when we sin. So should we sin that God's grace might abound? God forbid, or let it never be said. No. But it does give us the assurance of his grace and his forgiveness when we fail, and his ability to continue to use us as he renews our faith, as he restores us in service by his grace. We will sin. We will falter. He will not. He is faithful. Then we come to the last section. I know y'all are terrified that we still have from 17 through 37, but we'll do this quickly. As we said, Sennacherib is fully determined that he's going to take Jerusalem. He does not leave Lachish, but he sends three of his leading men to warn the city and to call for their surrender. Now, these are not necessarily names as much as titles. So the first is Tartan, who was the army's commander. The next was Rabsaris, which is a title for a high official in his administration, maybe even a high official in his army. And then the last one is the Rabshakeh, who is the chief cupbearer for the king and one of his leading men and his spokesman. He is a man who likely was well-educated and was gifted in languages. So these three stooges came with a sizable army to Jerusalem. And as they came to the wall, they called for Hezekiah to come to them. Well, Hezekiah does not. He sends three of his leading men instead, whose names are Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah. Sending them, he's refusing to submit to the authority of the king of Assyria. So the Rabshakeh is the one who speaks on behalf of the Assyrians, and he first addressed the three men sent by Hezekiah. And we'll just give a brief summary of what they say, what was said in two different addresses, and then the response of the Jewish leaders. So the Rabshakeh's first speech in verses 19 through 25 essentially taunted the Jews and fashioned his words around the theme of trust. In those verses, the word trust is used seven times in seven verses. Repetition of a word is very important, usually in interpretation and understanding of a passage. And so you get sort of a summary of his words. Basically, just exactly what are you Jews trusting in? Are you trusting in the words of Hezekiah? Are you trusting in the Egyptians? Which was seemingly always an option for the people of Israel. When they get in trouble, they may contact the Egyptians for help. Well, Assyria's already defeated the Egyptians. So anyone who trusts in them to rescue would be a fool. And he says that the Egyptians are like a broken reed of a staff. You lean on it, you're going to get pierced. You're going to get hurt. If you're trusting the Egyptians, that's not going to end well for you. Or are you trusting in your God? And the insinuation that's made here is that Hezekiah, your king, has angered your God because he has rid the land of all the high places where he was worshipped. And when he says this, he's demonstrating his ignorance of God's nature and his ignorance of God's commands. God commanded that in Jerusalem, at the temple, is the place where he was to be worshipped. And then he further taunts them by offering to give Jerusalem 2,000 horses if you can put warriors on them and fight. But he says, even if we do that, one of our soldiers will take care of all of them. You are weak. You have no hope. And the last and the worst of his statements indicated that the Assyrians had come against Jerusalem by the instructions of Yahweh. Your God has sent us to take care of you. So Hezekiah's leaders respond by asking him to speak in Aramaic, which is the language of diplomacy. not in Hebrew. Don't speak to us in the language that, you know, the rank and file who are standing here on the wall, kind of gawking and listening to see what's going to take place. Don't talk in the language that they can understand. Speak to us in Aramaic. And his response in verse 27, as we read, is very crude. And he wants the average Joe to know what's coming if they refuse to surrender. And then he issues his last speech in verses 28 through 35. And these words are intended to drive a wedge between Hezekiah and the people, to cause them to doubt the word of Hezekiah. And the speech here centers around the use of the word deliver. Don't listen to any promise that's made by Hezekiah. Don't trust in any promise that he says is made by God, because neither Hezekiah nor God will be able to deliver you. Your only hope for survival rests in the king of Assyria. Surrender to him and live. Have your own place. Have a future. And the words in verse 31 and 32 sound very similar to the promise that was made by God to the people of Israel on their way from Egypt to the promised land. Land flowing with milk and honey. And remember the words of the spies who came back and what they brought, this huge cluster of grapes. Similar words here. We wonder who this guy's working for. It's not God. Don't listen to these things. Don't subject yourself to the siege life. Surrender and enjoy the good life. And when you hear the words that he says, they sort of have echoes back to the Garden of Eden and the promises, the words of Satan to Eve. Promise of a better life. God's holding out on you. Surrender to the king of Assyria and you'll see what he can offer you. As bad as that is, he brings out the big guns then after this. And he says, beginning in verse 33, have any of the gods of the nations ever delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? No god of any other nation has been able to withstand Assyria. Your God is no different than the other gods. That's essentially what he is saying. It sounds like the pluralism of our day. Doesn't matter what you believe as long as you are sincere. You have no hope. You have no future with Yahweh. He is incapable of delivering you from the superior gods of Assyria. And then you see the response in verse 36 and 37. The people are silent. They answer not a word, just as Hezekiah had commanded. And these three Jewish leaders standing on the wall turn their backs and they walk away without a response. But then, as they were going to Hezekiah, they tore their clothes and reported what had been said. And we'll see Hezekiah's response and God's response in chapter 19. So Hezekiah here has come to another crisis point in his faith. Will he submit to the Assyrian king again, or will he trust in God? The gauntlet has been thrown, but the challenge has been issued to the Lord, just as the insults of the Rabshakeh had been against him. The God of Israel is not like the gods of the nations, which were images that were manufactured in the minds of men and carved by their hands. Not the God who has created all things. And what we're going to see is the trust of Hezekiah and the trust of Jerusalem is in the one living, true God. The New Testament makes it clear. You look in Romans 5 and you'll see that it makes it clear that our faith is in God, our hope is in God, and those whose hope is in God have a hope that will never be put to shame. Hezekiah is trusting God and leading the people to trust. So much so that it's very similar to the three Hebrew children who are going to be thrown in the fire. We have no reason to answer you. Our God is able to deliver us. Our God is unlike any of the gods of the nations. He alone is God.
Father, we thank you that you are our God, that you have redeemed us, and you've saved us through the gospel of Christ and by means of his death. Lord, we pray that you would help us to not yield to the voices around us that call for us to not trust you and to trust ourselves or to trust in our own abilities. But Lord, that we would ever look to you and to your word, and Lord, to know that you are a faithful God. Father, help us when troubles come to not lose heart. But Lord, may you use those troubles and difficulties in our lives to draw us closer to you, to depend upon you, your strength and your grace and your goodness to us. Father, these things we ask in the name of Christ. Amen.